friends, and welcome to the Summer 99 for the One Spotlight. We got all kinds of great calls and great pieces from our co-hosts that you're going to hear today. But first, I want to just talk about the fact that as we enter this summer season, all of us at New Life want to begin with one simple message. Thank you. In the last couple months, we have moved both of our offices. We rebuilt the studio. If you haven't seen it yet, you should tune in, whether it's NRB, Facebook, YouTube, and see the amazing transformation, just like we do in the lives of so many people. But I just want to say thank you because of your support, we're able to continue to grow and develop as a ministry and to help people across the world. This year, our nation is celebrating America's 250th anniversary, a milestone that invites reflection on freedom, courage, sacrifice, and hope for the future. Sounds like the same stories that we hear with our callers or maybe even you. For generations, people have worked, prayed, and persevered to build lives marked by purpose and possibility. And in many ways, that same spirit is reflected in what happens every day here at New Life. Because of your generosity and because of your willingness to support the ministry, people who feel stuck find hope again. Marriages that are struggling find a path toward healing. And men and women burdened by shame begin to experience grace. Families learn healthier ways to live in love. And individuals who thought that they were beyond help are reminded that God still has a plan for their lives. Every phone call we answer, every broadcast that is aired, every counseling session, every group, it is those moments that are a reflection of your generosity. You're part of what we do. 99 for the one, rescuing the one, restoring the many. In a time when so many people are struggling with anxiety, loneliness, division, and discouragement, your support allows us to continue being a voice of truth, compassion, and restoration. I was thinking about this recently. There are a lot of podcasts. There are a lot of broadcasts. And yet we're still the only one that are answering unscripted, unrehearsed calls from all corners of the earth. Literally, we've had calls from Budapest. We've had calls from India and in Omaha. We've got them everywhere because our human experiences are so similar. We have pain, we have relationships, we have struggles, and you're part of helping us help others find freedom in their life. That's the work that you're part of. Your giving is more than financial. It's an investment in changed lives. It's an encouragement to someone who feels alone, and it's a reminder that even in difficult seasons, God is still working through people who are willing to say yes. So this summer, as you gather with friends, your family, community, and you celebrate 250 years of freedom. And as we reflect on this historic anniversary, we simply want you to know how deeply grateful we are for you. Thanks for believing in this mission, and thank you for standing with us. Thank you for bringing hope and healing to so many people across the world. From all of us here, thank you. Now, on to some of our selected recordings just for you.
You know what, gang? I actually thought I would do show and tell today.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So those of you that are watching, which is nice because you guys can watch us, right, as well as listen. But I'm going to do my best to explain this. So this is my trauma berg. What's a trauma berg? A trauma berg is an explanation for how we hold trauma in our mind, in our heart, in our body, and the lies that get wired in at the impact of what happens to us. So at the very bottom, like down, 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 down in the bottom of the sea are basically life-altering, painful events that happen. Now, these can be either wounds of omission or wounds of commission. What are those things? Well, wounds of omission are the good things you needed but never got. That's like being delighted in, being seen, being heard, knowing that you have potential, and, you know, just having somebody notice you and honor you for that. Wounds of commission are the things that happen to us that should never happen to anybody. That's the physical abuse, the sexual abuse, the psychological abuse, all of that. Now, when those things happen, what happens to us? Well, we then have attachment styles. We decide how safe other people's are or not, and that's how we move into the attachment styles. Now, all the book we have, How We Love by Mylan K. Yurkovich, this does a really great example of explaining that. Now, what happens above that, right before the waterline, are those trauma-induced shame beliefs. Mm-hmm. Those are the negative beliefs that, you know, the Apostle Paul was the first mind coach, and he's like, hey, just want you to know it matters what you think. But those are beliefs like, I'm not lovable, I'm not in control, I'm not enough, I'm powerless, I'm helpless, I can't trust anyone. I'm shameful, like I'm irredeemable, right? Mm-hmm. And then that is all going on below the waterline. What we see in each other and observe in each other are what's on the iceberg. Mm-hmm. What are those behaviors? So this is when we see control, caretaking, dependency, guilt, low self-esteem, poor boundaries, powerlessness, perfectionism, shame, excessive responsibility. Like, we see that in ourselves. We might observe it in others, even family members or our partners. We see all this stuff going on, but we don't understand that it started under the water, started back in our origin. And this is what untreated relationship trauma looks like.
Someone told me recently, we don't have to talk about the past anymore, right? We can be done with that, and we want to be done. But in order to move on in a healed state, we usually do need to tell some of those stories in a safe place with a person that can help us.
So too, when the past is leaking into the present, it's not in the past.
Today, we want to talk about what advice would we give our younger selves? Kind of our, you know, if you could go back to pre-recovery JJ, pre-recovery Doug, what advice would you give? I think about the scene from the Shawshank Redemption when Morgan Freeman's character is sitting before the parole board one more time. And, you know, they ask the question, you know, do you feel like you've been rehabilitated? And he starts to go into the normal thing. And then he goes, you know, I don't even know what that word means. And he says, you know, there's not a day that goes by that I don't wish that I could go back and talk to that scared, angry little kid and tell him he could do something different with his life, right? He could choose a different option, different outcome. And so it got me thinking about, you know, what would I do? What would I say to my younger self if I could go back and talk to that 6-year-old kid, that 8-year-old kid, that 12-year-old kid? What would I say? And how would I want that? Why do I think that would make a difference? So I'll start that question with you, Doug. If you could go back and talk to young Doug, pre-recovery Doug, what would you say? What advice would you give?
You know, I've been thinking about this, and depending on, we make so many decisions in our life, right? And so going back as far back as I could, if I could talk to that little 5-year-old first, the first thing I would say is don't stay silent.
Oh, yes.
You know, don't stay silent. Don't isolate yourself. Tell someone what just happened. Even though it's scary, and you know, everybody in my family was big. I was real small, and so everybody in my family was big. And so these big people, you know, with these big voices, and but to say something, don't just stuff it and allow it to just seethe and grow inside of me, because some of that definitely, as I got older, fueled my getting into peer groups that I had no business being in. Mm-hmm. I had no, you know, you were talking about at your story, I'm not going to share it all, but you talk about the cheerleader thing. And there, you know, I've been thinking about some of these decisions to be in groups of peers and guys, and I would go back and I would stop him before he really got in too involved and going, hey, hold on. Is this the kind of life that you really want to lead? Because this is where it's going. We're known by the company we keep. And so the company that I was keeping was not healthy, but I didn't know it because all I wanted to do was belong. Mm-hmm. And each one of those groups, I didn't feel like I belonged in. So I just kept pushing. Well, now I want to belong to this one. Now I want to belong to this one. And I kept doing more and more and more, let's just say, unhealthy, dishonorable things. Mm-hmm. And that led to my drug history and sexually acting out and really trying to cope with my loneliness and my betrayal of friendships through substances. Mm-hmm. And sex happened to be a big part of that. Mm-hmm. And then that took over and that became the big monster in my life. And so some of the other substances took a back seat. And now that, since it's the greatest thing on the planet, I thought, right, I would say, look, you're messing with something that you don't know how to stop. It will not stop you. You don't have, I was talking to a client yesterday that said, you're in your Ferrari at 120 miles down the highway and you don't know that the brake lines are cut.
Yeah.
You cannot stop this.
You cannot stop this. And you think you are in control. You think you can control it, but you can't.
Every minute of the day, I can stop, I can move, I can change, kept going.
Right.
And the lives that I've ruined, the stories that I should not have been a part of in other people, I should have kept those to myself. And I would be having these conversations along the way going, hey, this girl is not good for you. This group is not good for you. This entity, these are not good for you. This is not where you want to be. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know where I wanted to be because I felt lost most of my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that fueled a lot of those decisions to get involved because, you know, even negative attention is attention.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, that starting phrase of, don't keep it a secret. Don't keep it inside. I mean, first of all, it resonated. Secondly, it made me think of the, we're only as sick as our secrets, right? Oh my gosh. Absolutely. I mean, that's what I walked around there. I was the golden boy on the outside, right? Got good grades, respectful, community service, blah, 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 blah. Yep. All my friends, parents, and any girls that I actually convinced to date me, all the parents loved me, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. So golden boy on the outside, but destructive on the inside, right? And that's what I kept secret, and keeping it a secret just kept it growing and growing and growing. That destructiveness, it was the 120 miles an hour Ferrari on the highway with the brake lines cut. Like it just got to the point where it took over. And if I could go back and say, you don't have to keep this a secret, you can share this with someone and it won't, not only will it not be the worst thing possible to ever happen to you, it's actually going to be the best thing possible. Oh my gosh. It would have changed so much of my story.
Hi there, Liz. Welcome to New Life Life.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have had a lot of trauma growing up, and I've gone to counseling, and they said you obviously have some anxiety and depression. And then recently I was just told that they think that I have PTSD, and it never dawned on me that I could have a diagnosis like that in everything. And so because I thought if you have PTSD, you're an angry person. And I thought, well, no, I'm kind of easygoing. I'm not an angry person or anything, but I have found out that I just might be angry and not showing it. So pretty much I'm sabotaging anything that I set my boundaries on. I'm sabotaging myself and I'm isolating. And I mean isolating a lot. And, rehashing, ruminizing over you know, what happened since everything was brought out in counseling in my childhood. And I thought, well, that's the past. Let it go. But I still have some unanswered questions. And I wonder if it has anything to do with how I am now. And my heart and core wants to help people. But how can I be productive and help people if I'm the one that needs help?
Becky, what would you say?
That's the question that all counselors ask themselves all the time, Liz, is how can I help somebody when I don't have it all right? Liz, one of the things I love that you just discovered that PTSD is indeed part of a lot of people's lives, even if it isn't showing up. I once had somebody say, well, I don't have any grief because I'm not in a corner crying. You know, we have these images of what these diagnoses like PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, can be experienced regardless of what you may think it means. But I think what you've identified is because of the feelings that you're having, the anxiety, the increase in anxiety, it's causing you to withdraw. And actually, those connections are really going to be powerful in your healing process. I don't know if you feel like you are learning enough about that. Is that happening for you, Liz, in your counseling experience?
Well, we've gone over everything, and I put a lot of stuff out of my mind, and it was, you know, everything. Boy, when you go to counseling, it's not pleasant. And so, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that went on, and I guess I am angry with my mother. Because she had a way of, I could not talk to my father. I was not allowed to talk, have a private conversation with my father. And she would always, she said we were alike, and my father was, he was kind of aloof, you know, and she was just a maniac.
The beginning parts of your life were this detachment from your father, but also a lot of chaos with mom. And so that's inside of you. And even though you can talk through it, a lot of the things that we talk about, even in counseling, is how, where we're feeling it in our bodies and how to work through that as well, because it's not just your thoughts and feelings. It also is, where is it manifesting in your body, and to work that out as well. But Ron, isn't it true that all of us people helpers, we're not perfect, and we, you know, we have our own work to do. And if you got a good one, it's because they're still doing their work.
Absolutely. You are spot on with that. Liz, I would just add this, trying to put something out of your mind does not mean that it is out of your brain. As Becky just said, your body will hold that difficulty, trauma, those painful experiences, and your brain will hold those things. And so anytime that part of you gets triggered, those memories, that pain comes right back. And you know what? That part of your brain that stores painful memories does not keep track of time. That part of your brain doesn't have a clock attached to it. And so when you feel those things, you feel them as if you were 6 or 4 or whenever that occurred in your life. And so it is as real now as it was then. Another quick comment about anxiety. Yes, anxiety is something we feel, but anxiety is also something we do. It is a form of coping with something painful. We move into rumination, and you get stuck there. And the more you ruminate, the more anxious you feel. And now you're afraid of your feelings, and the anxiety just withdraws. So those are the blame, shame, control, escape mechanisms that we run to. But all of that is a bit of a dead end street. It doesn't lead to freedom. What's going to lead you to freedom is, as Becky mentioned, is getting your counseling process. Perhaps some EMDR, if you're familiar with that, maybe we could talk around what that is. But there are strategies and techniques that are useful to help release the part, the memory, the painful memory in the brain, to help you process it as an adult, not as a young person, but now as somebody who has more life experience and wisdom and God's wisdom added to your who you are as a person. You can deal with the painful stuff in light of the present, and there are strategies that will help you get there. But you need to go into that space with a counselor and not be afraid of processing what has been painful and what you tried to avoid in the past.
Liz, thanks for calling in today to New Life Live. We have a tip sheet that we want to call, send you. It's called 6 Tools to Ease Anxiety. And there's also an article at newlife.com called 8 Tips to Stop Anxiety Dead in Its Tracks. We will put that in the show notes there.
I'll tell you something that's on my mind every week because I see it every week in my private practice. And that is, I call it love is free, but trust is earned. And as Christians, this is where we really can get wrapped around the axle. And myself too, because what we do, it's for me personally, it's one of the hardest things to consistently put in practice because our desire to give this unending grace and going, it's okay, well, we forgive you. Because what we want to do is we want to see who the person can become. And that's, we end up, here's where we get wrapped around the axle. We make our decisions based on who they can become, not who they are presently. And that does no one any good. So if we really look at love is free and trust is earned, love has no limits on forgiveness. God instructs us to, we always say we don't pull the throttle back or push it forward on grace. Grace is free, but trust is earned. And many of us have not been taught that. It's a discernment. So we can't control what the person does, what they say, how they treat us, but we can control how we respond. In fact, Proverbs 4:23 tells us it's our responsibility. God doesn't just say, oh, hey, when you think about it, guard your heart. No, he says, guard your heart because it determines everything you do. And that can feel really mean if you grew up looking for the good and having a misunderstanding of forgiveness, because forgiveness is about, really, it's our best gift to us because I can release the person who owes me the debt. It's about the past. But reconciliation, and this is where people get confused, is about the future and what's happening. So there are 3 things we need to do if we're going to allow someone back on our personal property if they've injured it, because our heart is our personal property. Here's the 3 things. Godly sorrow. It's more than I'm sorry I hurt you. I always say put wheels on that sorry and drive it. But it's a godly sorrow is other focus. It's empathetic. It feels the sadness. It's like, oh my gosh. It's what Peter did when he denied Jesus. He was devastated he denied Jesus. It listens, and here's the key word, it isn't defensive. But it leaves the door open for future questions because there's no expiration date. The second is ownership, naming the behavior and understanding it. The third is reconciliation, and that's walking it out, a participation in a process where new experiences are learned. And this, my friend, will save you a lot of grief. Put this into operation.
Becky, what are your thoughts on what Laura shared?
Well, you know, it's not the first time I've heard Laura share this because we go way back. But it's funny because in our Christian walk, we are taught forgive and forget. We're taught look over the bad things and let it go. All the things that there is a little bit of truth in that, a little bit. But the hard part is, where do we draw the line? And even the third point, Laura, when you talk about reconciliation, we know that there's a long journey to reconciliation because guess what? Forgiveness does not always lead to reconciliation. We want to get, onto a truth finding mission. And like we've said so many times, safety in relationship is of utmost importance. And so when you get to the truth and you know the truth, it will set you free. And then you can make a decision of whether that person is safe to be in relationship with again.
Right. And you know, Becky, the John 8:32, because that's, you know, the truth and the truth will set you free. We quote that all the time, but it's a then verse, right? So 32 hinges on 31 that says, if you're truly my disciples, you will embrace my teachings. Well, the Lord, the way he designed our nervous system, we are made to remember. And that's for a lot of good things. But we can't override our nervous system in the way God's designed it. That's why the lady who called in earlier, she's trying not to focus on that, but that's miserable because her body is sending off the alarms going, this is not resolved. You are not safe yet. You all have not reconciled, right? So there's a lot of misunderstanding. And you know, Becky, because we go back so far, that this is one of my, I'll be saying and teaching on this until Jesus comes back, because we want to align with his truth so that we can be set free.
I'm going to quote the late, great Tim Keller, you know, is people are idle factory machines, you know. Mm-hmm. And so one of my things is I love control and how control and protection, self-protection show up oftentimes is in the form of judgment. I can be a really judgmental person. Mm-hmm. For instance, everyone who drives faster than me on the road is a maniac. And everyone who drives slower than me doesn't know what they're doing.
Right, right. Right.
You know, and I mean, we can joke, but the judgments can come in these much more kind of nasty or sadistic ways that really, at the end of the day, they harm us and they harm others. And it's not that we don't have sound judgment. It's not that we can't call evil evil or seek good and call out where good is good. It's that we don't understand our vast limitations. You know, my little soapbox behind this is that, you know, the tree that messed everything up for humanity was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Mm-hmm. And it's just this humble recognition that we as human beings have this very limited understanding of good and evil. And that's why we have scripture. That's why we have God's design and the laws and the prophets and the New Testament. But I also want to take it a step further, because there's this verse that really convicts me. It says, you therefore have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else. For at whatever point you judge another, you are condemning yourself, because you who pass judgment do the same things. And I don't think we consider that enough. And this verse is Romans 2:1. And it's really a warning that when we remove ourselves from grace, when we move ourselves from self-examination and putting ourselves under kind of our own spotlight, not with condemnation, but with sound judgment and grace, we lose our way, we lose our path. And one other thing I want to mention about this verse is that when Paul wrote Romans, when he wrote any of his letters, it didn't have chapter and verse. Mm-hmm. It was just one continuous letter. I think there is a huge mistake that we make in separating Romans 1 from Romans 2. Romans 1 is this long list of sinful behavior, ways in which we are way outside of God's design. And oftentimes we as Christians have this temptation to use that to weaponize that list of sins against other people, mm-hmm. i.e. use judgment. The irony is the very next verse is, therefore you have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else. For what other point you do that, you're condemning yourself. One of the solutions to this I'm seeking to do today is self-examination and confession. Mm-hmm. Grace, the grace of God.
Yeah.
When we clean out ourselves, when we focus on the plank on our own, we are so much better to be a conduit of God's goodness in the world.
Today I want to talk about forgiveness. So in the Gospel of Matthew chapter 18, Peter the Apostle, he actually goes to Jesus and he asks a very human question. He says, how many times should I forgive? That's the kind of question that we all wrestle with a version of. Sometimes it's, do I have to forgive? Should I forgive? Because forgiveness isn't easy. And Jesus responded in his typical way that he did. He told a parable. And so he said, a servant owes a king 10,000 talents. Now, for context, a single talent was worth about 20 years worth of a laborer's wages. So to owe 10,000 wasn't just a large debt. It was an impossible debt, is what Jesus was saying. Billions, right? There's no way he could ever repay it. So the servant begged for mercy, and the king did something shocking. He forgave the entire debt. Now, of course, a debt that big would have come at a great cost to the king to deal. But then that same servant goes out and he finds another servant who owes him 100 denarii. That's about 5 months worth of wages. So yeah, it's a decent amount of money, but something that probably could be repaid. And that servant begs for forgiveness, but he has him thrown in jail. Now, there's no real explanation needed to understand the meaning of the story. It's pretty clear that if we want forgiveness, we got to also extend it. Now, that's a story, But then there's a real life story of Corrie ten Boom, who survived the Nazi concentration camp. And then afterwards, she went around preaching forgiveness. And after one service that she was preaching forgiveness, one of the guards from the camp that she was at, who was particularly cruel to her sister, and her sister died in the camp. And he came up and he said, oh, it's so good that we have forgiveness. And she said in her heart, she said, Lord, I do not want to forgive this person. Mm-hmm. And the Lord said to her, you know, forgiveness is an act of the will, and the will can function regardless of the temperature of the heart. And so what she goes to show there is something that psychologist Everett Worthington describes as decisional forgiveness versus emotional forgiveness. Emotional forgiveness is, I feel like forgiving someone. I'm there. And they're mentally and they're emotionally. Decisional forgiveness is, I don't actually feel like forgiving the other person, but I'm going to make a conscious decision to go ahead and do it. Now, he comes up with this acronym and he describes it with REACH. So R is for recall. You honestly remember the hurt without minimizing it to yourself. But then you empathize. That's the E. You try and understand the other person's perspective, even if you don't agree with it. Then A is for altruism. You reflect on the time that you were forgiven, and then you choose to extend that same grace. C is for commitment. You make that decision that you're going to choose to forgive. You've made that commitment. And then H is for hold on, because those feelings come back. And when they do, you just have to remind yourself that I'm doing this. Now, Jesus also reinforced this in the Lord's Prayer. He said, forgive us our sins as we forgive those who forgive against us. Right? He came up with this very uncomfortable scale. So here's what I say. When we don't forgive someone, what we really say is that Jesus's blood isn't enough for them. And in doing so, we say it's not actually enough for us, because we forgive others, not because they deserve it, but because we don't deserve it. So if forgiveness isn't a feeling that you have right now, you can still take a step if you're willing. You can make that decisional forgiveness. Like, and even if that decision is, I want to forgive that person. So you can do that. And if you do that over and over and over again, it's more likely that the feeling of forgiveness will follow.
Yep. You mentioned that acronym, REACH. And I know people out there were like, wait, say it again, because I was trying to write it down. So if you don't mind repeating what REACH stands for.
I will say it again. REACH stands for, R is recall. You honestly remember the hurt to yourself without minimizing it. The E is for empathize. You try and understand the other person's perspective, even if you don't agree with it. A is for altruism. You reflect on the time that you were forgiven. And so then you extend that same grace because you were forgiven, not because the other person deserved it. C is for commit. You commit to making that decision. You might even state it out loud that I am choosing to forgive this person. And then H is for you hold on to that commitment, because when that, you know, it happens one moment at a time, forgiveness. And so when those feelings come back, you remind yourself, I already have made that commitment to forgive.
Yeah. Becky, any thoughts?
Yeah, well, and to that point is, forgiveness is one big decision followed by a bunch of little decisions. Mm-hmm. It is that reminder you're talking about, Mark.
Jan in Seattle, listening on newlife.com. Welcome to New Life Live.
Thanks for being there.
Of course.
How can we help you? You're my favorite people. I am a little bit discombobulated. I am calling it because of complicated grief with having lost so many close relatives, 3 grandchildren and 3 daughters.
Ooh, oh, my goodness.
In 5 years. And so I just wonder if I'm not actually talking myself into being ill. Is that possible? I had my first EMDR meeting, counsel, and I've been counseling for a few months with just a psychological counselor.
When you said you're wondering if you're talking yourself into it, do you feel like since you've been in therapy and talking about the grief that you're feeling worse?
I find that my brain is not, it's malfunctioning in some way. Like I forget things that I've never forgotten before. Mm. It's just feeling discombobulated. That's all I can say.
And how have things been going with your therapist?
the EMDR was horrible in that I was not even remembering how to use my iPhone. That's probably the most disconcerting thing that's happening is I'm very techie. I've many devices. I've always been that way. I mean, for 19 or earlier years, you know, 50 years now. It's just like talking, trying to carry on a conversation right now. My mind is not clear.
So, Jan,
I'm wondering what's going on.
There are a couple different possibilities that it would be good for you to explore. EMDR is a fantastic form of therapy, and I highly recommend it. I also know it to be a very safe form of therapy. So I would question whether or not attempting an EMDR session is what has led to you not knowing how to use your phone, which of course would be frightening. Now, EMDR is also not a fit for everyone, and it just syncs well with some people, and others really struggle with it. So I would have you, of course, talk to your EMDR clinician about your worries and decide whether or not it's worthwhile to still try a couple more sessions, because it can take a few attempts at eye movement desensitization and reprocessing for it to really work and for you to let your brain flow with the process. But forgetfulness and feeling a fogginess, that can be just a part of grief. It can be part of trauma. And the level of grief you've been through sounds traumatic. Yeah. And it is also a symptom of depression. So I wouldn't stand with certainty that it's because of EMDR that's happening, but rather I'd get a full physical done. I'd have blood work done. I would do some memory testing and talk with your clinician about whether or not to continue EMDR.
Jackie?
I agree with everything Dr. Ellis said. I might even ask my primary care doctor to give me a referral to see a neurologist. That way you're just covering all the bases and making sure that this isn't happening because of a medical issue. And these things all could have just all happened at the same time. And also looking at all the other aspects, your complicated grief brings about fatigue and mental fog. It can bring up, you know, depression symptoms. All of those things can make you more confused. And in EMDR, we're opening up to processing. And I wonder if you opened up and now your mind is full of thoughts. And so it's hard to find the word. It's hard to slow down and focus on something because there's just so much going on in your mind now. And as Dr. Ellis said, I would take that back to your clinician and talk that through and decide what the next steps should be in terms of EMDR. And I agree. I think it's a very safe modality and incredibly helpful. Is it possible this could be a part of it for you? Absolutely. Anything's possible, but it's also just as likely that it's something else. And so check the other things as well.
Like too much sugar?
I would say having a full physical, because as we get older, things change in our body and things change in our mind. And if you have a small little TIA, a small stroke, oftentimes we don't even know that that happened until something bigger happens. Sometimes people are having problems in their body and they chalk it up to stress. And later on, they find out it was something else going on and it got worse. And so if you're doing regular physicals, then you have a baseline. There's blood work that's being done annually, maybe even x-rays of different sorts or CAT scans of different sorts or ultrasounds, depending on what your situation is. But there's a baseline. And so they can check and see if there has been a change.
It's also okay, Jan, to slow down therapy, which might sound counterintuitive, but when people's pain is too raw, sometimes they need to spend many sessions, months or even years, being built up to the point where they can then address the pain. So also tell your clinician if it feels like it's going too fast and you need it slowed down. We clinicians, we need feedback from our clients about whether or not we're pushing too hard or not hard enough. So you've got some good discussions to have with your therapist.
Phil, listening to us on Sirius XM channel 131, says here you're a truck driver, so you may not even know where you are right now, but do you have an idea? What state, at least?
Yeah, I'm in Pennsylvania now.
Okay. Well, thanks for taking us along for the ride. How can we help you?
Well, to put the question first, it's how do I deal with my older brother with an inheritance dispute?
Okay.
What's the dispute?
Yeah.
Okay. So mom died on November 4th. And I've had a hard time with it, just being honest. And it's been difficult.
Of course.
I was very close to my mother. Very close. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's a huge loss.
Yeah.
4 weeks later, my wife's mother passed.
Oh, wow.
Oh, man.
Yeah,
so sorry.
So both moms.
So, yeah, so I kind of pulled, I did go back to work, but I pulled back from the responsibilities, some of the responsibilities of dealing with finances. I just pulled back and I just kind of left it with him. And so we're co-trustees for this, for her trust. And so the problem now is that, you know, it's a 50-50 split. There's two of us. He's older. The problem is, and I don't know, I want your read on this issue. I understand what he said, but I think it's a power play more than a real thing. I think it's a power move. So he told me, I'll give you X amount of dollars, but I'm going to hold back a certain amount of money for fees that need to be paid. When I ask him, what are the fees? He won't tell me. And then he threw another caveat out about something that was done for me last year. So he feels it's fair to hold back money this year.
Okay. Chris, you had a question for Phil.
Well, Phil, as I'm hearing about this, you know, first and foremost, so sorry. The amount of grief that we can hear that you're still carrying, what we would want you to be able to do is get a lot of care and guidance for that grief, first and foremost, because this is a very significant loss in your life, and you need a lot of care. Your wife needs a lot of care through this season of it. Going back to your relationship with your brother, that's what I want to focus on. I want to focus on the relationship, because over and over and over and over, I've seen that trusts do the exact opposite. They break trust. That people, when they're fighting over, when family members fight over money, and it creates all kind, you know, it's like the love of money is the root of all evil. It's because we look at money as our ultimate solution to all of our problems. And so it becomes too important. In fact, it takes priority over relationship. I don't know what your relationship is or has been with your brother, but what I would want in this situation is that the quality of connection and relationship and trust that exists between you and your brother be maintained as much as humanly possible. As there seems to be some untrustworthy behavior regarding the inheritance that your brother has displayed, I would recommend this. What I would recommend is you go to your brother and be like, hey, we have very different ideas about how this trust and when this trust should be split up and how these funds should be utilized. I want to honor you. I want to honor mom. I also want to honor myself in this process. Let's get a third person legal mediator to help us navigate how these funds are distributed, when and how. And that way we can protect our relationship, our brotherhood, apart from haggling over the details of the trust.
Yeah,
setting that above, because a lot of times too, when there is, you know, siblings, siblings usually do see things differently in families.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they can harbor resentments and, you know, unfairness. And so sometimes using this to level the playing field, like you got more good stuff from mom, so now I'm going to equalize it with money.
Yes.
And so we try to work out, or some people try to work out relational difficulties through the money, because it's the last thing you have from a parent if you have that. And so that's not the arena, Chris, that is best. And that's what I hear you saying.
Yeah.
Let's elevate the relationship. Now, your brother may balk at that because then hiring someone, they, you know, they get a little chunk of money. But I think preserving relationship and just emphasizing that being the priority, because I have seen people that no longer have anything to do with their siblings, because especially so close after a person passes, it's like, this is a piece of mom. This is me holding on to mom. This is my, you know, value to my parents. And we misconstrue it to be so much of what it isn't.
Well, and I think it also it reminds me of a Steve Arterburn-ism.
Okay.
Okay. Fairness or fair is where pigs go to get ribbons. Right. I've seen so many times, I was counseling a family with this last week. It was the parents, and they're trying to make everything fair. And I told them to stop. Mm. Because everyone's idea of fairness is going to be different. Mm-hmm. That ledger is never going to work out. It doesn't mean that you're not trying to balance things out and be appropriate or move towards fair, but like trying to get this equalizer for all the things, it just doesn't happen. It's not going to work out that way. And it puts the emphasis on the wrong focus. Mm-hmm. The wrong focus is who's getting what material possessions or resources.
Right.
That's not it.
Yeah.
And often parents don't, you know, put things in place and then say, okay, go equalize it as you see fit. Yes. It's yeah. No. And there are legal ramifications for not executing it correctly.
Yes, exactly.
And you have to follow those. So that's why it's good to get that legal advice too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Phil, thanks for calling in today to New Life Live. We have a tip sheet that we're going to put down in the show notes there, too. It's called 12 Steps to Recovery from Grief. This is something that will definitely help you and your wife during this time. And we pray that things get worked out and resolved between you and your brother, and that you'll find the right people to come alongside you during this time.
So I'm going to talk about family today.
Family, okay.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke in Austin, Texas, on complicated families. And I might have even said this on the air. I said to the people, thousands of people, great big mega church. And I said, how many of you do not have a complicated family? No one raised their hand in each service. I never had anybody say, yeah, I don't have a complicated family. So we have complicated families. So what I thought about was, I'm going to do a quiz. And I'm going to wonder, I wonder how Becky's going to do and how you're going to do on this.
Oh,
okay. So here's the quiz.
Oh, boy.
What is the most often quoted scripture in the Bible? I have the answer. I'm not a Bible theologian, but I have the answer, and it relates to what we're going to talk about. Anybody
Jesus
want to take
wept.
Us? Jesus wept. You're a good Baptist. Shortest verse in the Bible.
I would say the one about judgment. Don't judge me.
Yeah, don't judge me.
Not, it doesn't say no, don't judge me, bro.
So it is with great deep honor and respect that I get to say to Becky, our president, and you, Brian, you're both wrong. So maybe you had something in your mind, listeners, and maybe it was John 3:16. Maybe it was Psalm 23. I mean, there's so many great scriptures. Well, this is it. I guarantee you, this is it. It's called the Shema. It's in the Old Testament, and it's actually in Deuteronomy 6:4-9. And it's a trick question, because every morning in an Orthodox Jewish home, they quote it every evening. And by the way, when Jesus was born, there is no doubt in my mind, I wasn't there. I'm old, but I was not there, that Mary would have picked up that baby at one time, and she would have recited these words. And we need a roadmap sometimes with our families. And again, all families are complicated. No shame here. We just have complicated families. But we do have a roadmap, and it is found in this. And this is the roadmap for the Hebrews, but it's also, you know, our roadmap too as Christians. It says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord," and this sounds familiar to you, I bet, "our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your strength." And really what that means is loyalty and fidelity to God. So in the midst of all the turmoil that goes on, and, you know, in whatever season you're in, and it might be a tough season, what we want to do is do our best to bring loyalty and fidelity to God. And that's what we're challenged to do. It goes on to say, "These commandments that I give you today are to be written on your hearts. Impress it on your children." We get so many calls here with kids who are estranged, if they're adult children, or kids who aren't doing well, or, you know, so many family things. And yet our job is not to be preachy and lectury, and that doesn't work. But our job is to learn those commandments, put it into our heart, live it out, and then impress it on our children. And I think that's what we're called to do. It goes on to say also how you transmit faith and love. And you know where it comes from? In the home, because it says talk about it when you're at your home, and when you walk along the road, and when you lie down, and when you get up. So in other words, bring God into your home. I'm not saying that's going to be perfect. I'm saying that's the roadmap for us to do life and make it less complicated, even in complicated times.
Thanks for listening. If you've gotten to this point in the recording, I want to encourage you. Maybe this is the year that you take a next step. You can go to newlife.com and find out all of the different resources that we're offering. If you haven't participated in a webinar yet, why don't you check one out? As well as our courses. We've got so many people who are seeking that next step in their lives. Stay in touch with us. Call us with your prayer requests and be looking for our calls to you to say thank you. Have a great summer. God bless.